Rise, oi, 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 all persons having business before the United States Court of Appeal for Veteran Claims, draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States in this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. We're here this morning for the case of Carl V. Lamb versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Gordon Mansfield, case number 053495. Who will represent the appellant, Mr. Lamb?
Jeff Wood, appearing for the appellant.
Okay, Mr. Wood. And for the secretary, who's representing the secretary?
Richard Daly, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Daly. Now, Mr. Wood, I understand that from the clerk that your client is in the courtroom, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Lamb is.
Okay, would you like to invite him to join you at council table?
If he'd care to, that would be fine.
That's all.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Lamb.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Wood.
May it please the court.
Before you start, may I ask you, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
How much time?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you to lean a little bit closer to the mic or speak a little louder so make sure I can hear you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. May it please the court, at issue before the court today is a claim for an earlier effective date for a 10% rating for the appellant's PTSD. The element of the effective date is the last of the five common elements to a veteran's application for benefits under the Calaro decision, and Calaro obviously has been relied on again and again for the list of those five common elements. As the court has recognized, veterans benefits litigation is frequently protracted. In the Ingram decision in 21 Vet App 232, that panel there stated that even a savvy veteran may not be aware that there is a disagreement as to which document raised the claim until after an effective date is assigned. The regional office has assigned an effective date of December 1995 for the appellant's 10% rating for PTSD, but it is also recognized that PTSD was formally diagnosed as anxiety disorder. I draw your attention to record page 206 and 207. June 1996 rating decision. In the middle of the page, indicating under where it says decisions, 2, evaluation of post-traumatic stress disorder, parenthesis, previously diagnosed as anxiety reaction. Page 207, post-traumatic stress disorder, formally diagnosed as anxiety disorder, and then it lists the three different ratings that the appellant has had for that disorder since 1951. So, after receiving notice of what his effective date was, Mr. Lamb has filed an NOD in 1996 with respect to that effective date.
Counsel, if I may interject, are you pursuing any Q claims currently, and if so, could you clarify which ones they are?
We are pursuing Q claims, and we are pursuing the Q claim that has been briefed at pages 8 to 10 of the appellant's principal brief.
And what is that argument?
That argument is that the VA violated its own regulation in 1957 when it reduced the appellant's 10% rating to zero.
And that's the good cause for failure to appear at the exam argument?
Yes.
Okay. And your second argument with regard to due process?
Yes.
Is that in the context of a Q claim, or is that not?
That is not in the context of a Q claim.
Okay.
Okay. That due process argument is alleging that the 1957 rating reduction is not final.
Can we talk about that for a minute? The issue of why the the 1951 or two claim was not final.
Do you mean the 51 or the 57 rating reduction?
Well, that's correct. The rating reduction.
Okay,
why it's not
1957.
Is there any issue that Mr. Lamb received notification that he was awarded service connection at the 10% rate in 1952?
Well, let's see.
You don't take issue with that, and it's nowhere in your brief. You don't take issue with it.
According to the record, he was provided notice of his award at record page 430, and we stand on that record.
Okay. So let me ask the question again. You're not disputing that he received notice of the 52 decision?
No, okay. We're not disputing that.
So if he received notice of the 52 decision and he was indicated he was supposed to get compensation at the 10% rate, doesn't that place him on some sort of notice or expectation that he should be receiving the income at some point and make inquiry about it?
Not if the compensation had been subject to recoupment of disability severance pay, which it was, as
right.
Also indicated at record page 430.
Okay, but still he realized that he was, I understand he didn't get it for a period of time until the $1,600 was recouped, and that would have taken until sometime in 1957 for that to occur. So he wouldn't have been getting a check, but he knew that he would be getting a check at some point, right?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay,
that.
All right. I understand. You can't say what his state of mind was. Mr. Lamb, according to the record, I believe, did in fact notify the VA of a change of address in 1954, did he not?
Yes. That's my understanding, and that's what the record indicates.
Doesn't our case law require and acknowledge a requirement for claimants to keep the VA advised of their current address?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Lamb, by performing that action in 1954, followed that regulation.
We would agree with that, yes.
Now, what was Mr. Lamb's address in 1957 when he was supposed to get this notice?
His address was at the trailer court in Bristol, Virginia.
And didn't the VA mail the notification to the trailer court?
That's what the record indicates, yes.
Okay. So how did the VA breach any duty? Explain to me how the VA, your allegation is that the VA, it seems to me that the VA did not perform its, in your case, in what you would say is a constitutional duty to provide notice to Mr. Lamb before it terminated his compensation.
Yes.
How did they fail to do that if they mailed the notification to the address that was in fact Mr. Lamb's address? And tell me why is that a violation of due process?
When the VA's notice letter was returned to the VA as unclaimed. It then had a duty pursuant to the small decision to make a reasonable effort to locate the appellant. And they could have done so by contacting the appellant's parents in order to find out Mr. Lamb's address, where he was.
If I can, please go ahead.
Well, counsel, isn't it true that under the small decision, the court found that the individual was in custody and that the government should have known that he was in governmental custody, mm-hmm. and that's why they ruled the way they ruled? Mr. Lamb was not in custody, was he?
Certainly not, no.
Okay. And so your contention is that when they received the notice back as undelivered, okay, the VA was supposed to undertake an investigation or a hunt as to his precise location so that they could personally deliver this letter to him or get it sent to him?
I would quibble with your word investigation. I don't think that it requires an investigation simply to look in your own file that you possess for an alternative address. I would argue that they had the duty to do at least that much. If you want to call that an investigation, I think you're using that term a little broadly, but that's so good.
Is the basis for your articulation that they should have looked in the file to contact his parents because it's his parents or because it was his prior address?
Because it was his parents. Isn't it a reasonable inference that a parent is going to know?
Well, is it a reasonable inference that his parents are still located at the same address? Let me shift tacks. You present your argument under the constitutional due process clause.
Yes. Yes.
Does the Constitution provide any greater obligation on VA or remedy to your client than VA's own regulations and statutes require and provide? And if so, what would that be?
Well, counsel has recently filed a document indicating some regulations that were effective in 1957. Section 3.7 of those regulations indicates that the veteran's non-receipt, or when a veteran does not receive notice of a VA decision, that does not toll the time in which to appeal. That is in the last sentence of the regulation. We do not believe that particular regulation complies with the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. So we would therefore argue in response to your question that the DP clause provides greater protection than the VA's own regulations that were effective in 1957.
In your brief on this notice, and if you want to move off notice and go to do your argument about the clear and unmistakable error, you know, I don't want to hold you here, but on with regard to notice, in your brief you cite the Mullane case from the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Okay. And as I read this case, which was decided in 1950 and I think would clearly be applicable because it was decided prior to the relevant events in this case. I think the Supreme Court talks about the requirement of notice being that's reasonably calculated to provide notice under the particular circumstances of the situation, all the facts in the case. which would mean, I think, taking into consideration the nature of the agency involved, who the claimant is, and the regulations of the agency, and so forth. What factors can you point to that, from which you would argue that the notice provided and actions taken by the VA did not match up to a notice that is reasonably calculated to provide Mr. Lamb with the information that his claim, and he was required to go to a medical examination, and that not appearing at that medical exam, that his benefits were terminated, or, as the regulation says, suspended?
There would be three facts that would respond to your question. The first would be the return of the scheduling, the letter, the return of the VA letter to the VA that had scheduled him for an examination would be the first. The second would be the return of the letter to the VA of the rating reduction letter. And the third would be the record, the file in the VA's possession indicating that they had an address of a close relative, such as a parent.
With regard to the due process claim, you referenced the Ingram decision.
Yes.
One of the sort of prerequisites that Ingram discussed was whether the court had jurisdiction over the claim for, or the argument that there was an unadjudicated claim pending. Does this court have jurisdiction over the issue of whether the due process violation that you articulate tolls the 1957 decision such that it is still pending?
You're asking me whether this court has jurisdiction?
Yes.
Well, at every step of the process during the proceedings below, this argument has been raised. It was raised before the BVA. They gave us a decision with respect to this issue. So, yes, the court has jurisdiction.
Well, let me be more specific. If the appellant is arguing that in his notice of disagreement with the, I believe it's 95 grant of benefits, 96 grant of benefits, he argued that his effective date should go back to 1957 because of his due process violation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a freestanding finality argument prohibited under DiCarlo and Rudd, or is it a valid challenging of the effective date as envisioned in Ingram? Because if the attack is as to the 1957 decision as opposed to the effective date determination in the 1995 decision, then it would be a freestanding finality attack.
The contention that the due process clause to the Fifth Amendment was violated in 1957 is the basis for the appellant's contention that he's entitled to an earlier effective date. It is not a Q claim. The due process violation is not a Q claim. It's the basis for the contention that he's entitled to an earlier effective date of 1957.
I appreciate what you're arguing. But what my point is, DiCarlo and Rudd said that you couldn't just come up to the court and argue effective date if the underlying claim is final, or if you're attacking the finality of the underlying claim, and it has to be through an appropriate avenue, one of them being Q, another being through the challenge of the effective date selected in the current adjudication stream.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with that particular line of cases.
I've looked at them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me ask it, that question in a slightly different way. Try to, at any rate. Does this appeal at the court stem from Mr. Lamb's disagreement with the effective date assigned in 1995, I think it was, when he was actually accorded service connection and assigned an effective date for 10% and later 50% evaluation? Or does it stem from a direct attack on the 1957 RO decision, independent of the 95 decision?
Stems from the effective date decision that was rendered in 1995.
Okay. And what is your basis for pointing to that?
The appellant's NOD that was filed in July of 1995 or 96.
Just by its very timing, or by the content of it, or?
By both the timing and the content.
I don't believe that the NOD reflected a request for an appeal or an intent to seek appeal. But I don't have the page in the record at my disposal.
The panel is aware, of course, that the timing of an alleged NOD is important. The context, the factual context.
Yes, of course.
Has to be considered.
Well, we can.
The first sentences are, thank you for your award letter.
Can you
June
point me
11th,
to the page, please?
Record page 216. Sorry,
thank
Your
you.
Honor. It's addressed to the adjudication officer at the Huntington Regional Office. The first sentence of the letter is, thank you for your award letter of June 11th, 1996. In accord with your instructions, I am replying because I think the VA is wrong. I believe the effective date should be retroactive to my original claim. Following are my reasons why.
Okay, well, thank you. I see that you're out of time.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Daly, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and with me is co-counsel David Quinn, Deputy Assistant General Counsel. We would briefly like, Your Honor, to answer the questions posed in the Court's October 17th order, and then before expounding upon those answers, clarify a few issues that I think may have been confused based upon the pleadings filed and the inference drawn from the Court's order. First, the question regarding whether a Q claim may lie against a non-final order. No, it may not lie against a non-final order because it need not lie against a non-final order. The way that we've construed the second question is to ask whether the correspondence to the formal application submitted in 1996, December of 1995, could be construed as being associated with the claim stream from the putatively non-final decision in 1957. Assuming the non-finality, the answer is yes. However, the Secretary does not concede that that decision was non-final because he asserts that he, in fact, did satisfy all duties required by statute, regulations, and the Fifth Amendment. Moving lastly to the question regarding the appropriate remedy for that decision, an NOD was required because, again, we assert that the 1957 rating suspension was, in fact, final, Your Honor. But the clarifications that I think are fundamental here are, first, there is no unadjudicated claim here, nor is there a freestanding claim for
either. Just ask, I'm sorry to interrupt you so early, but I want to clarify this. You say that the 57 claim is final, and I take it the only way it could be final is if proper notice was given of the adjudication.
Your Honor is correct.
So if we were to accept appellant's argument that it's non-final because proper notice wouldn't be given, would the Secretary's position be that that claim stream remains open?
Yes. Okay. There's no other way to construe that, sir.
Okay.
Again, though, there is no freestanding claim for an earlier effective date or challenge of finality. And lastly, I think most importantly, and Your Honor touched upon it, is what we're dealing with here is not a rating reduction, but merely a suspension of compensation pursuant to the applicable regulation 2.51 existing in 1957.
Could I ask a question about that?
Yes, sir.
If, in fact, we're dealing with a suspension, and basically, as I understand the operation of the suspension at that time, is that somebody gets a claimant, a veteran, gets award compensation. The VA has the right to ask them to come in for an examination to see what the status of their disability is, to see if it's increased or decreased. So if they fail to show up for the examination, then the compensation is suspended because they didn't show up as they were required to do. And but it is suspended. And it's suspended until such time as the veteran actually gets an exam.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then when the person gets an exam, he actually may be entitled to retroactive compensation, assuming that there's been shown to be no change in the individual's condition.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. That is subject to...
Why is it in this case, I mean, aside from the legalities that we're talking about here, that isn't exactly what happened? He didn't show up for the exam for whatever reason. He files a document with the VA, and the VA, as a result of that document, which the VA treats as a claim for an increase, they give him an exam, and lo and behold, they rate him for the same disability, although now different terminology, at the same rating. So why doesn't the VA automatically say, okay, you came to the exam as we asked you to, now you get retroactive compensation all the way back to 1957, because you obviously still have the disability?
Well, because the evidence of record for the interim period from 1957 to 1995 is an absolute dearth of any medical evidence of any disability whatsoever, aside from appellant's.
But that would be true at any time. There's a dearth of medical disability between 1952, when he was originally assigned a 10% rating, and 1957, when he was asked to come back. There's a four-year dearth there, and they were obviously prepared to do some sort of rating there, which would not involve taking away money.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the regulation then, in effect, was dealing with prospective determinations of compensation eligibility. There was no...
Well, not termination.
Suspension.
That's right. I think that's very important here. The board at times lapses into the terminology using termination, but the regulation says suspension.
Correct.
And so I'm having a hard time, I agree that there are more years, but I'm not sure that more years makes any difference. So I know we have all these legal issues floating around here,
right,
that we've got to deal with, but that is a basic question that I have, and I was hoping you could answer for me.
Well, we can certainly sympathize with Your Honor's confusion, because throughout the development of this record, stemming all the way back, the terms were somewhat inartfully used interchangeably between reduction, termination, and suspension. But ultimately, the answer to your question, I think, rests in the fact, again, that the regulation then in effect was a prospective regulation. So, assuming from 1951 to 1957, there was an absolute dearth of any medical evidence whatsoever, by operation of the granting of service connection back in 1952, that's an immaterial fact unless and until the secretary or then the administrator pursues the operation of then 3.251, or actually 3.184, which require the medical examinations from time to time for non-static disabilities. Moving forward from that point, however, that's when the evidence of record becomes determinative. And in the instant case, there absolutely is no evidence between the two. But all of this discussion really assumes away the operation of 3.330 from 1957, which was the finality regulation that said you have a year within which to do something. All actions start the window of appellate eligibility, and that window closes after 1 year from the
date. Does VA have any obligation to develop evidence to determine what the appellant's condition was between 1957 and 1995?
Assuming for purposes of argument, Your Honor, that we do, that duty was satisfied in the instant case, and appellant raises no argument about the duty to assist, notwithstanding the board's inaccurate characterization of his actual arguments.
Okay, to pursue that, I believe in the brief that the secretary concedes that the appellant had two Q claims pending and that they should be remanded for the board to address the merits. Is that accurate?
Does
the secretary still pursue that?
I would not characterize the secretary's brief to read that there were two distinct Q claims. The Q claim that was before the board was the putatively inappropriate application, or rather misapplication, of the adequate reason provision of 3.251 from 1957. The board mischaracterized that argument as a failure of the duty to assist, because it did not pursue alternative addresses at which to locate the appellant. The board's characterization of that argument, I don't think, is imputed into the secretary's brief. So in that regard, no, I do not agree with that characterization. There was just one Q claim that the secretary's brief addressed.
And so with regard to the effective date part of the claim, the non-Q, we'll call it,
okay,
which the board didn't really seem to recognize, would you agree with that? Or confusing board decision.
Yes.
Let's put it that way.
It's not a model of clarity, and we will concede that. However, Your Honor, I think that it does sufficiently reach the question, just inappropriately reaches the question, because what it did is it conflated two separate distinct legal theories into one and then adjudicated them in, quite humbly, quite a mess. And that was the purpose for the secretary taking the posture that it should be remanded to the board to clean up its own mess and not exhaust judicial resources here.
If we were to find that the 1957 claim was not final because of an impropriety in the notice mailing, then would it still be appropriate for the court to remand for the board to pursue an investigation of the Q claims? If there's no finality, what Q claim is there to, or how can a Q claim lie?
Well, it cannot. And to the extent that the secretary's brief did not adequately address that, and you invite us to answer that question outside of the four corners of that pleading, I would suggest that would be a basis for the court to go ahead and reach the decision.
Okay.
Thank you. So, as I understand it, you agree with the proposition that this court can decide the constitutional issue without a remand?
Correct, Your Honor, I do.
All right. One of the disturbing elements, I guess, of the record below is the fact that it would appear that the theory was that once the notification has been returned as undeliverable, that all obligations cease and you just walk away from further efforts. I'm not sure that that's what the Mullins case says, and I'm not sure that that's an accurate characterization of what VA does. Would you agree that possibly once something is returned, notification as an example, to report to a physical exam, that the VA may have an obligation to go through the file and see if something was missed, to make sure that the envelope was appropriately addressed, that type of thing?
Indeed, Your Honor. There would be a further duty, and that gives rise to the inartful assertion that a basis for remand was the board's failure adequately to address the presumption of regularity. I think more accurately stated, what the secretary was driving at in that point was the failure adequately discuss the theories supporting the case law, the discussion in the case law regarding the presumption of regularity. Because what we have here is a situation where there's no evidentiary gap to fill, so that presumption is not required to be applied. Looking retrospectively, we see that there would have been no fruit borne by pursuing any alternative record address within the record, because as appellant himself and his wife concede, we sent it to the correct address. It simply came back because appellant, either through willful ignorance or neglect, failed to tend to his affairs at home while he was away working. So pursuit of alternative records addresses in the record would have been fruitless, but to the extent that there would have been anything viable in there, the case law for the presumption of regularity only speaks to issues about pursuing addresses at which you could find the particular appellant or claimant, as the case may be.
Well, let's go with that. The appellant has argued that you should have contacted his parents, and if you had contacted his parents, you probably would have been able to find the appellant.
Your Honor is correct that that is a distinct possibility. However, Your Honor touched on that point in addressing appellant's argument with the appellant's counsel, and that there is no basis upon which to conclude that that was still a viable address for the appellant's parents. Moreover,
yes, but the presumption of regularity case law is full of cases where VA writes to old addresses, to forwarded addresses, where they take, you know, quite extensive efforts to try and track people down before they terminate or deny benefits.
Well, I'm not familiar with cases where they've sent notice to addresses that they know are no longer valid addresses, as in the instant case where appellant three times said, well, on three distinct times, indicated that the addresses that were of record, I'm no longer there, I am now here. At last, he communicated with the secretary, or I'm sorry, again, the administrator at the time. He informed us that he was in Virginia at the King's Court trailer park, and no subsequent time thereafter did he indicate that there was any other place at which he could be contacted. Nor is this similar to the situations like Small, where you're dealing with custodial situations. All of the case law expressly talks about addresses at which you could find the particular claimant in the particular conflict. In the instant case, there was no address like that of record. The only addresses of record were addresses that he affirmatively told us were no longer valid. And to the extent that you can draw an inference that contacting family may avail us of knowledge of where he was, even assuming that duty exists, which the case law does not support, Your Honor, they would have done nothing more than tell us that we sent it to the right address. Therefore, any duty would have been an exercise in futility.
No matter which argument we find persuasive here, I think we're still going to have to address perhaps what is the minimum, what are the parameters of the VA's responsibility to notify somebody?
Well,
and if I could continue, the
please, sir.
And looking, I look at this Mullane case, which, unless you tell me another case is sets out the parameters better, then it seems to me, the way I read it, what they're talking about is under the circumstances, the minimum duty under due process is to provide, where notice is required, to provide notice that is reasonably calculated under the circumstances to provide notice to an individual. And I asked Mr. Wood this question, I'll ask it of you. What are the circumstances in this case that would say, you know, the VA met its duty? And what is the range of the duty that the VA is required under that case to, you know, what are the responsibilities to meet the minimum?
Well, as you've posed the question, Your Honor, I think the parameters are somewhat amorphous. But in the instant case, everything that should have been done under the circumstances was in fact done. We sent two parcels to the same address, which subsequently turned out to be a correct address. And they were both returned as unclaimed or, for purposes of case law, undeliverable. Looking earlier into some of the language in Mullane, the Supreme Court said that sometimes when you're dealing with missing persons, which apparently could at least analogously be the case here, even perfunctory, knowingly futile notice would satisfy the due process requirements. Treating this situation as that, we assert that the Secretary satisfied any duty that was placed upon him by the Constitution, the statutes, the regulations, and in fact.
So you would say that once they've sent a mailing and get a response not deliverable, there's no further duty, at least in this case. Is there ever a time where there would be...
If there is information in the record indicating that there is another viable address, then yes, Your Honor. However, in this instance, we sent it to the correct address. It was received. It was returned. We sent something else to the same address. It was received. It was returned. We sent it. He got it. He failed to take advantage of it. For whatever reason, not to impute any guilt upon any party here, but the Secretary did everything that was required of him, and for the onus to be shifted back to the Secretary to take extraordinary measures is simply not required.
Thank you.
So it's the Secretary's position that the constitutional due process clause doesn't impart any greater obligation on VA than its own regulations or statutes?
No. In fact, to the extent that one analyzes canons of construction, if it were to, then that would make 3.103 absolutely meaningless. Apparently, having addressed the court's concerns regarding the issue, we conclude the Secretary's presentation on the matter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Wood, rebuttal. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. My colleague's repeated characterization of his client's conduct during the proceedings below is inartful pleading is too kind. We believe there's some evidence of bad faith here on the part of the VA. If we take a look at record page 716, we find a statement of the case in February of 2005, addressing the veteran's claim of clear and unmistakable error in the August 1957 action to terminate benefits. And the language there used is the writer of this document, in the last paragraph I'm referring to, the writer of this document, however, fails to find such a rating. There is no reference to an exact date in August. In fact, there's no reason to believe one was ever made. And yet, at record page 687, we have a rating decision from October of 2004. Also addressing the Q claim. And we have clear the context of that rating decision. It's very clear that there was an August 1957 rating decision. That's in record page 686 and 687. Last paragraph. Next to the last paragraph, it says, in August 1957, based on your failure to report for a VA examination, the RO discontinued payments on your award of service connection for anxiety reaction. And you know, I read those two statements, one in the October 2004 rating decision and the other in the 2005 statement of the case, which is supposed to explain a rating decision. And understand how those two statements are consistent with one another.
So the lack of consistency, at least under your argument, is evidence of bad faith?
We believe so, yes.
Do you have anything else to suggest bad faith?
There were other instances, there were other instances in this record in which the VA has admitted that there was an August 1957 rating action taken. They may not have termed it a rating action, but it was, in effect, a rating action. If the court looks at record page 681, in the first paragraph, the issues under appeal, according to this letter, our entitlement to an effective date prior to December 11th, 1995 for the assignment of a compensable rating for service-connected PTSD, and whether the August 1957 rating action should be revised or reversed due to clear and unmistakable error. Thirdly, there's a rating decision all the way back in August of 1996 at record page 518 in which the VA admits that there was a rating action back in 1957.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wood. I'm having a difficult time following why these, the fact that the VA is characterizing this attempt to revise the effective date as a clear and unmistakable error, why that's evidence of bad faith.
If you have three instances of the VA admitting that there was a rating action discontinuing payment of the award that was in effect at that time.
Correct.
And then you, on the other hand, have some schmo at the regional office
let me stop you right there. And I'll let you continue your argument. But those kind of comments about adjudicators in the Department of Veterans Affairs are not appropriate here. Okay?
Okay.
Go ahead. So some adjudicator at the regional office
is going to ignore three documents that the VA issued and tell us that there was no rating action that could be found in the file in August of 1957. Explicitly contradicted. Three documents that his own federal agency had produced prior to him reviewing the file. We believe that's evidence of bad faith.
Okay.
Lastly, Your Honors, I'd like to cite to the court the Myers decision at 16 Vet App 228, Penn Site 236, which addressed the BVA decision denying an earlier effective date for an award of service connection. The Myers panel observed that an original claim filed by a veteran in 1958 for service connection was still open, and that original claim for service connection was still part of the current claim stream. And we would rely upon Myers in praying for this court to reverse the BVA's decision denying an earlier effective date. So, unless there are any further questions.
What is your position on the VA's suggestion in our brief that this matter be remanded to the board to enable them to address the issue of the motion for revision based on clear and unmistakable error? What is your position on the VA's brief, which says it ought to be remanded for them to address that?
We are not happy. We would not agree to a remand. The CUE claim has been presented to the VA time and time again. They've not addressed it on the merits. This court obviously has jurisdiction. It has jurisdiction to hear the due process argument. And it
the process relates to finality. I'm interested now in the motion for revision for clear and unmistakable error.
Yes.
Okay. The VA says, you know, that's right. But the board didn't explain why they didn't address this portion of the regulation and didn't apply it, and we want to send it back to give them the opportunity to look at that. You would oppose that. What is it that you would like the court to do instead of remanding?
We would like the court to address the CUE claim on the merits.
And decide it?
Yes.
In other words, you would like us to make a finding that if an individual does not get notice in fact and fails to show up for an examination, that is, as a matter of law, good cause for an individual not to show up for an exam.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have any authority for that proposition? Because we would only get there, of course, if we found that the VA's efforts to provide notice were adequate.
I believe.
And that, in other words, the notice requirement had been satisfied, even though he didn't actually get it in hand and didn't know he had an exam. I know I'm keeping you beyond your time here.
Your Honor, it's been some time since I've read the Heisen decision, which was cited in the brief, the appellant's brief.
I'm sorry, which decision?
The Heisen decision.
Okay.
To the best of my recollection, I believe that that would provide some authority in response to your question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, did either of my colleagues have another question?
No.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wood.
Thank you.
Okay, the case is submitted. Judges will greet counsel at this time.
All rise. Put you down here and get your bubble noodles.